Welcome back to the course in Critical Theory, Cultural Studies, and Postmodern Theory, Considered in Terms of Civil Liberty. This is Lecture 6, and in Lecture 6 we will treat Cultural Studies. Cultural Studies is typically neglected in treatments such as this, or in discussions of the academic left or the new left. This is not typically treated as an important part of the new left, as substantially contributing to the new left criticism of the new left movement. For example, you'll not see it mentioned in terms of cultural Marxism. And recently, for example, I watched a film on the new left in which David Horowitz, the founder of the Freedom Foundation and the publisher of Frontline Magazine and other enterprises, he was interviewed, and he doesn't mention cultural studies. He goes on at length about the Frankfurt School, and in particular Herbert Marcuse and the formative impact that Marcuse had on the new left. But no mention is made of cultural studies, so one might wonder just why that is. Is it just not important? Is it lacking in impact? I have to beg to differ with that view, because there, in many ways, cultural studies has outpaced, outstretched, outlasted critical theory. Whole departments are devoted to it in universities across the United States and across the world. It is a field that is either a discipline or an interdisciplinary concentration. This isn't the case for critical theory. You'll be hard-pressed to find a department called critical theory or even an interdisciplinary concentration called critical theory, whereas you'll find thousands of concentrations or fields or disciplines called cultural studies. So cultural studies is here, and it's basically here to stay, as far as we know. So what is it? I've gleaned a definition from a website, the University of North Carolina website, their cultural studies site. I think it's an interdisciplinary concentration in that university. And this definition is very typical. It treats cultural studies as this interdisciplinary field of research, teaching, investigating culture, transforming the way culture transforms individual experience, everyday life, social relations, and power. It's research and teaching that explores the relationship between culture and as human expressive and symbolic activity, and distinct culture as a distinctive way of life. It says it combines fields from the social sciences and humanities, including literary studies, sociology, communication study, history, and cultural anthropology, and economics. It says it works across these fields and boundaries. Now, I think that economics, you'd be hard-pressed to find an economist actually teaching in cultural studies, but you will find economics, and you'll find Marxist economics, but no economists per se. I think the definition is typical, and it's typical for leaving out the most important factor that led to the development of the field, and that is its Marxist class-based perspective and mode of analysis and commitment, and the crisis posed in this period for the Marxist left and the left in general. And this is around the mid-50s. The absence of the field in the absence of Marxism, or the mention of Marxism, can possibly be understood by looking at a brief history of the field, which is one of the things we'll undertake today. The absence is explicable with reference to the crisis posed for Marxism at this time, a crisis that prompted the development of the new left, which in Great Britain, which cultural studies is arguably the expression. So the new left developed in the mid-50s, and cultural studies developed later as the expression of the new left. The new left was born in Great Britain. It's usually dated to 1956, and there were two major factors that contributed to it. One was the Soviet-backed Hungarian armies put down of the Hungarian uprising, student uprising, in November of 56. The Hungarian uprising sought to oust the one-party Soviet-backed People's Party that ran the People's Republic of Hungary, and this began as a student protest. And then the British communists actually backed the Soviet actions, which came on the heels of Khrushchev's secret speech in 56. So, and that, of course, included the denunciation of the purges, the gulag system, and other horrors in the Soviet regime. So these two factors combined to cause a legitimation crisis amongst the left for the Communist Party. It's triggered a mass exodus from the party's ranks in Britain, and they would have to do something. The second factor which precipitated the rise of the new left is often thought of as the invasion of the Suez Canal Zone by British, Israeli, and French forces in late October, early November. Now, this factor could be seen as a justificatory one, that is, a justification for keeping the left left, for keeping the left alive. After all, you have one factor that's prompting the exodus of communists from the party, and you have another factor that says, look, we still need to oppose capitalism and imperialism because look what it's doing. The British action, the invasion of Suez Canal area was condemned widely, including by President Dwight Eisenhower. These developments combined to accelerate a credibility crisis within official British communist circles because both actions were basically supported by the Communist Party, and so therefore they were seen as outrageous provided quite a legitimation crisis within the Communist Party circles. So these two events catalyzed the beginning of the new left in Britain that sought a way forward for Marxism despite the problems in the Soviet Union and the squelching of revolution in Hungary and the Western imperialist aggression, which certainly was used as a justification for leftism to stay left. Further, the fact that the working class in Great Britain was not the continually impoverished mass that Marxism predicted led to a new focus. So once again, we see working class not being the immiserated body that Marx had predicted, instead enjoying wealth, enjoying consumer products and mass media. This was a problem for Marxism. Like the left, the new left that would develop in the US later, as mobilized by the Frankfurt School, the problem for Marxism was that the workers were not the impoverished mass necessary for revolution. Here's a very, very telling quote from Stephen Gosler. He's a leftist, and he argued about the importance of poverty for the working classes for traditional Marxists. Politics. He said, quote, traditional left organizations like the Labour Party and the Communist Party of Great Britain found themselves unable to articulate the shifting foci of political disaffection among a working class base that had been largely shorn of the material conditions of deprivation and hard poverty, which had functioned as old standbys for the left's political rhetoric. So, you see here the language, even the language that's used, has to make increased wealth into a negative. They were shorn of the material conditions of deprivation and hard poverty. Not they had rose in wealth or they had risen in wealth and had enjoyed greater comforts, but rather they were shorn of deprivation. That's very telling. By the mid-50s, many people in Britain were enjoying a new affluence. They were enjoying consumer goods, mass media, entertainment, and so forth, but this was a problem for Marxism. As with the Frankfurt School, this was figured as a negative development, seeing in consumerism the death of the Marxist project, and that, unless that is, a new criticism could be developed, and that's exactly what cultural studies began as. The Cold War and the numbing conformity, as they put it, of consumerism were among the new foci for the development of the new left and the new criticism that would evolve as cultural studies. The Cold War did help keep the left alive in the sense that both the West and the East were involved in it, and it showed that U.S. imperialism and U.S. capitalism served as the basis for the Soviet development of the nuclear weapon in opposition to the West. So it wasn't so much strictly a dialectical process, but rather the fault of U.S. Dominance. A new socialist project or dissident communism developed between 1957 and 1959 in Great Britain. It was almost as if the new left had to maintain its criticism of capitalism at all costs, despite the increasing wealth and the upward mobility of the working classes. So a group of Marxist academic historians and adult education teachers would develop this new critique that eventually gave birth to cultural studies. These academics, mostly historians in the first place, they were anxious to revive the old English radicalism of the 19th century for the new left of the 20th. So they sought to justify the maintenance of the left by looking to the fact that there had always been a radical opposition to the rise of industrial capitalism in England, and amongst the radicals there, one could point to Cobden and Richard Carlyle and George Holyoake and so on and so forth, that there's a real tradition that the left is very proud of in England, and they thought they could bring it into play in the 20th century. These historians included Doreen Lessing, Christopher Hill, John Saville, Rodney Hilton, Eric Hobsbawm, and E.P. Thompson. Some of these should or may be familiar to you. Eric Hobsbawm, a major historian of the rise of capitalism and the Industrial Revolution. Christopher Hill, a major historian of the British Revolution, English Revolution, and the rise of Cromwell and the radical religious sects that developed in England. E.P. Thompson, a historian of the English working class, who wrote a book called The Making of the English Working Class, seeing this class as a construction of history rather than and conscious deliberation rather than something that's mechanistically produced by capitalism. These historians were connected with this periodical called The Reasoner, which it took its name, I should say, I think, from The Reasoner developed by George Holyoake in mid-19th century, in which he developed secularism, which I studied and written about a great deal. This group inaugurated a new Marxist humanism, which aimed to put the working class subject back into Marxism while repudiating Soviet-style totalitarianism. So we have a refashioning of Marxism based on the Soviet disaster, if you will. The way to go about this was to put the human working class subject back into history. This way you could make sense of the Soviet totalitarianism and how to avoid it in the future. The movement suggested that real revolutionary change could only be achieved as a genuine and lasting success by a movement that took seriously the human experience of social being and working class consciousness. So a focus on the social life of the working class and their actual consciousness. So this project would be much more empirically based than the Frankfurt School. They will study social life at a grounded level, and a granular, much more granular level and focus. They will look at actual working class people and the way they live and the way they think, what they consume, what they think about what they consume. It's an empirical study of the working class as a group. While the academic Marxist historians looked to history to locate an English radicalism, there was another contingent that looked for radicalism in the contemporary moment in cinema and popular culture. It would be this other contingent that carried on as cultural studies. The academic historians, Marxist historians, had focused mostly on British working class in Northern England, but this other group came out of Oxford and was more cosmopolitan and diverse, and they were the younger generation. They were the ones that would continue on as the founders and participants in cultural studies. But like the Northern academics, they also sympathized with Marxist humanism and a critique of the centralized socialist statism of the Soviet Union. So they were also humanists. And this is a distinction within Marxism between structuralists and humanists. Structuralists see the system as all determining, and humanists see the human subject as important, so they both fault each other for what the other lacks or has too much of. The structuralists, like Louis Althusser, the French structuralist Marxist, would ridicule this such humanism as focusing as if the human being had some sort of role to play in the development of socialism. He thought it was entirely a scientific matter, and it was determined by the structure itself. The humanists, on the other hand, were considered more romantic and subjectivist, and they placed an overimportance, a vastly overimportant emphasis on the human subject, the working class as a subject who had a role in history. These new humanist Marxists, or newly humanist Marxists, look to older traditions of socialism in England, in particular guild socialism and the Owenite socialism of Robert Owen, and cooperative movements like that of Owen and Holyoake and others. They had a kind of wistful, nostalgic view of the 19th century radicals and its cooperative movement, which failed abysmally in all of its attempts, like the Queenswood colony and other colonies within England. What they did is they thought to colonize various places and set up colonies of socialism within the country, and they all failed because they didn't have any capital base for production and distribution. This group focused around, this other younger group, the cosmopolitan group, focused around the periodical Universities and Left Review, and had taken the Oxford seminars of G.D.H. Cole, an important historian of leftist radicalism in the 19th century. I've read many of his books. They imbibed his critiques of statist socialist models. So they're looking to revive the British or the English traditions of old socialism and to counter them to the Soviets. Their analysis used a cultural frame for investigating class politics in an affluent society. They're going to study culture and study culture through a cultural frame. The first issue of Universities and Left Review described their aim to investigate class, quote, as a matter of a whole way of life, of an attitude towards things and people within which new possessions, even a new car or a new house or TV set, find meaning through use. So rather than just simply denouncing working class consumerism, they thought and sought to understand it. So in that sense, they're more empirical less dismissive of the working class, say, than the Frankfurt School. But they did this in order to try to find and resuscitate that working class culture and subject, largely. This is from one of the co-founders of the cultural studies, Stuart Hall, in his essay, A Sense of Classlessness. So, like the Frankfurt School, however, and following Antonio Gramsci, the cultural studies critics aimed their critique at institutions, including the political role of key cultural institutions like schools and the university system, but also, in their case, much more towards the mass media, although the Frankfurt School had treated the mass media, especially Adorno and Horkheimer, in their essay, Cultural Industries, Enlightenment as Mass Deception. This would be much more granular and grounded critique and study. Now, this is a relatively received history of cultural studies. It is as described in Dennis Dworkin's book, Cultural Marxism in Post-War Britain, History, the New Left, and the Origins of Cultural Studies. It's very interesting that Dworkin identifies cultural studies as a cultural Marxism, as part of cultural Marxism. It is cultural Marxism in Britain. So here we have it. And this is by no means coming from some right-winger. He's identifying cultural studies as cultural Marxism. This history is the generally received history. There have been some recent accounts since that have complicated this history, but the alternative accounts of cultural studies are really of no importance for us because the cultural studies founders themselves actually adhere to this historical perspective of their development. That is, they arose from the New Left and its responses to the crisis of Marxism at the period in the period of time at hand. Two key books mark the beginning of the project of cultural studies, which anticipate the actual founding of cultural studies as a school of thought. These are Richard Hogarth's The Uses of Literacy in 1957 and Raymond Williams' Culture and Society in 1958. You need to have read these books, not you. One needs to have read these books to be a practitioner of cultural studies. Richard Hogarth, The Uses of Literacy, was concerned with the attitudes and relationships that made up the culture of the working class. So here we go. He's trying to get into the actual mindsets of workers and their relationships to each other and to the culture at large, or the broader culture. He suggested that Britain was made up of several cultures, one of them being working class culture, of course. He was concerned with mass culture and its erosion of a distinctive working class culture. This is a preoccupation of cultural Marxism entirely. What was mass culture doing to a distinctive working class culture, if one ever existed? He focused on literary analysis, particularly of mass publications, including newspapers and family readers. So here we have the beginnings of what people will ridicule much later, like cultural studies, people studying cartoons, studying The Simpsons, or studying, you know, the productions of Disney and so on and so forth, and considering it worthy of study like Shakespeare. Well, this is where it all started. The focus on mass publications and newspapers and family readers, like in the U.S., something like Reader's Digest, was seen as worthy of effort because it would point to what was attempted to be done to working class consciousness through mass media. Raymond Williams' Culture and Society is another foundational text, and his was a study of culture and literature. But at the time that he wrote, the approach to literature had been close reading in the schools of Leavis and others. The New Criticism was the method that was au courant at the time. New Criticism taught that you don't look at anything outside of the text to find out what it means. You don't look at biography, you don't look at history, you don't look at culture, you don't look at anything but what the words say. Well, Raymond Williams was the beginning of this new cultural context, this new consideration of and concern for the culture that brought forth literature, the context of the culture, of the context of the literature, and what it had to do with what was written. He suggested that the very notion of culture, in fact, came into usage as a concept during the revolution, Industrial Revolution, just as it was being destroyed. So it was the Industrial Revolution which threatened culture, and the disappearance of culture made it visible, he suggested. He rejected the claim that there was a distinctively working class culture that could be isolated in the present moment because it had already been eroded by industrial capitalism. He suggested industrial capitalism destroyed whatever working class culture had existed in England or Great Britain. He did suggest there was this bourgeois culture that was based on an individualist idea and a working class culture that was based on the basic collective idea. So the workers' culture was seen as collectivist, whereas the bourgeois culture was seen as individualist. So, in other words, individualism was framed as bourgeois and collectivism was framed as working class. But there was a constant interplay between the two, and there was a common culture underlying them. And then was mass culture destroying working class culture. So he sought to develop a new common culture and a new socialist man that would derive from and grow out of the culture that existed. And so he said, quote, a culture while it is being lived is always in part unknown, in part unrealized. So it's under development. And this is where cultural studies would come in, to try to develop a culture that would produce the new socialist man. And finally, the culture, not finally in terms of we're not ending here, but finally, the Birmingham Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies was founded in 1964 by Richard Hogarth and Stuart Hall under the aegis of the English Department at Birmingham University in Birmingham. It was conceived from the outset as a political project rather than as an intellectual one, and this is key. And this is from Stuart Hall, one of the co-founders himself. And he says, I have begun with this history of cultural studies to separate myself from those who would read the birth of cultural studies as an intellectual project, while I want to insist that it is, in fact, born as a political project, as a way of analyzing post-war advanced capitalist culture. So he makes no bones about the fact that this was a political project meant, it was inaugurated by Marxists who meant to revive and refashion Marxism for the contemporary moment. And the big question and the big problem he put straight up, and what was the problem that cultural studies would address? Quote, what happened to the working class under conditions of economic affluence? This is written in Cultural Studies, 1983, a book of his lectures about cultural studies. This comes after many people had been practicing it already, and he's like the founder stepping back in to set the record straight. This period in the mid-50s on was considered the American phase of British life, which was therefore and thereafter thought of as bad, because everything American is bad to the left intelligentsia in Europe. So the American phase was marked by, according to Hall, quote, the diminishing sharpness of class relations, the drifting and incorporation of sectors of the working and lower middle classes into professional and non-professional commercial classes, the beginning of mass cultures, the massive penetration of the mass media, and the beginnings of the television age, the rapid expansion of a consciousness led by consumer advertising, etc. So it was deemed to be a real tragedy that some working class people were moving into professional and non-professional commercial classes. They were having upward mobility. They were, you know, and then, of course, the penetration of mass media and its erosion of any radical consciousness was a problem. The horror, as Joseph Conrad said, wrote in Heart of Darkness in 1902. The horror, the horror. These changes presented enormous problems of analysis for those looking at the society, said Hall, because the working class was not suffering the immiseration predicted by Marx. In 1960, Daniel Bell would refer to this development as the end of ideology, that is, the end of the opposition between capitalist and socialist ideology as such, because it was over for socialism, we thought. Cultural studies would treat this problem in terms of culture now, rather than politics or economics, strictly speaking, although culture itself was seen in terms of politics. Culture was political through and through, and political change was the object of cultural studies. It's an activist academic discipline and endeavor. So cultural studies was, from the outset, bound up with the new left, the politics, an actual world, real-world politics that existed in not only the academy, but well beyond it. And the new left realized, quote, the importance of cultural change in this period, but found little help in the existing Marxist bag of tricks. For the most part, the concept simply didn't appear. This is Stuart Hall again. That is, the concept of culture didn't appear in the Marxist bag of tricks because Marxism had not thought that culture was an important area of concern. Culture, as I said before, was a development, an effect of the economic base. And when the economic base would change, so then would culture. So culture was not conceived as something that would effect any change. It would always just be the result of it. Here we have culture considered as a causal factor. In other words, orthodox Marxism would not do. It would have to be modified, although it was not to be abandoned. Because this course now is devoted to the understanding of cultural Marxism as it relates to liberty, the point is not to teach you how to become a critic in the School of Cultural Studies or any other of the schools under consideration for that matter. Therefore, it is not necessary to examine various texts and the ways that these and other works of cultural studies engaged in culture and politics, except to note that it did, and from what standpoint and to what ends. Suffice it to say that it grew out of a tradition of British socialism and emerged when socialism was threatened by increasing affluence, in particular of the working class. Nevertheless, the School of Cultural Studies spread well beyond its British context and became applied much more broadly, such that a cultural studies of this or that region, this or that culture, became not only an academic endeavor, but also it became a means by which an ever-renewing socialist project was also spread into academic circles and the culture at large. Cultural studies spread to the U.S. and established itself first in English departments, but also penetrated many other disciplines, including sociology, media studies, which it helped to found with the Frankfurt School, history, and many others. Cultural studies, this shouldn't say lecture 10, cultural studies penetrated academic disciplines and became an interdisciplinary school set up separately in its own right. It is the field in which I acquired my own PhD from Carnegie Mellon University in literary and cultural studies / theory. The department was first called literary and cultural theory and then changed to literary and cultural studies while I was there. And I read about this in my book, if you'd like more personalized approach, Springtime for Snowflakes, which is a serious book despite its title. It goes into my whole academic career and, it's a memoir of my academic education. Cultural studies, despite or even because of its focus on culture, has been a means by which a devotion to Marxism has been kept alive in the academy and thus in society at large. While not dogmatically Marxist, it nevertheless understands culture from a Marxist class-based perspective, while aiming at a decidedly socialist analysis and objective. It is decidedly less inimical than the Frankfurt School in the sense that it doesn't aim at negating everything existing in favor of a socialist future, but it is rarely taught in isolation from Frankfurt School criticism. They are bedfellows that often travel together. Thus, it can be thought of as a cultural bed, speaking of bed, that serves to nurture the more pernicious Frankfurt School and the more decidedly ruthless criticism of Marx in general. Cultural studies teaches culture as a form of power, is a carrier of capitalist ideology. Combined with Antonio Gramsci's notion of cultural hegemony, cultural studies, along with the Frankfurt School, and despite its differences with Marxism, postmodern theory, are the sources of cultural Marxism today. Thank you. That marks the end of our discussion of cultural studies.